Mr. Martinez?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Section 285 grants district courts discretionary authority to look at the totality of the circumstances and award fees when necessary to prevent gross injustice. Such awards can be proper in unusual cases where the losing party has committed bad faith or harassing conduct during the litigation or has advanced objectively unreasonable legal arguments, just as courts had held under the 1946 statute. The Court should restore this understanding of Section 285 and make four additional points that we think will clarify the inquiry for the district courts. First and most importantly, the Court should say that baselessness and bad faith do not both have to be present in a case in order to justify a fee award. Second, the court should say that district courts can grant fees based on a combination of different factors, even if no single factor would necessarily support the award on its own. Third, the Court should say that an objectively unreasonable argument can trigger a fee award, even if that argument is not so unreasonable that it's actually considered frivolous. And fourth, the Court should say that clear and convincing evidence is not required. I'd like to turn to Justice Scalia's question and the discussion that occurred earlier about the battle of the adjectives, so to speak. We think that, as I said earlier, that the fee award should be appropriate or can be appropriate in a case in which there's an objectively unreasonable litigating position or objectively unreasonable arguments that are made in a case. We appreciate that that's not a 100% precise, bright-line test, but we think it's similar to, and it's in fact the same as what the Court has said in other contexts, such as EJA in the Pierce case.
No matter what other factors exist, it has to be objectively unreasonable. I mean, even if it is clear from other factors that this is a shakedown, a big company trying to suppress a little company, even if it's clear that there has been outrageous litigation abuse, misconduct by attorneys.
It is an important point. Just
all of those things cannot justify shifting the award unless it is objectively unreasonable.
No, Justice Scalia, that's not our position. Oh, okay. Our position is if the only factor is an objectively unreasonable argument, that in appropriate circumstances that can be sufficient.
We believe
very, very strongly that if there are other factors present, that would only strengthen the case for
a few days. You did. I see that. But look, what you listed in your brief on page 17, which I think was non-exclusive, willful infringement, litigation misconduct, inequitable conduct by the patentee in securing the patent, vexatious or unjustified litigation, bad faith, the assertion of frivolous claims and defenses. And then you cite cases which say all of those in different instances have been sufficient either alone or together. Well, why don't we just copy that? Isn't that your view?
I think our view is that those are the kinds of circumstances.
All right. Do you want to add to that list or to subtract?
I think as long as the Court makes clear that that is an illustrative list that I think captures the kind of bad.
You want to add et cetera, right?
And add or similar well, equitable, similar inequitable conduct, which is what the Ninth Circuit said in the Park Inn Theaters case, which I think all the parties agree fairly captures what Congress intended to incorporate from the cases decided in the late 40s.
So where does gross injustice come from? I understood that to be your test. You say fees are authorized when necessary to prevent gross injustice to the defendant.
I think,
and again, you have your long laundry list that doesn't say anything about gross injustice.
Well, I think the long laundry list reflects the kinds of circumstances in which courts operating between 1946 and 1952, interpreting the prior statute, those are the circumstances in which those courts had concluded that there was a gross injustice. And so, in other words, we think gross injustice is maybe the umbrella term.
You don't think it. Where it comes from, which maybe you don't want to say, is the Senate report on the bill that is similar to this one enacted in 1946. Now, still, there are some of us who think that's a highly relevant consideration.
We are comfortable saying that, and we do say that, and we think it's especially salient and worth relying on here, not just because it's the legislative history, but also because that same legislative history and that same gross injustice language was repeatedly cited and talked about in the 1946 to 52 cases.
But I think, Mr. Martinez, what the Chief Justice is driving at is there's a bit of a disconnect between your list of factors and those two words. Gross injustice, I mean, that's really, really exceptional. That sounds like shocks the conscience. That sounds like something you've never seen happen in the litigation system ever. But then you're saying essentially ratchet it down when you list all these various factors. And maybe that's right. We shouldn't be obsessed with this word gross injustice. It just seems a disconnect between the two words and all the factors.
Let me explain by stepping back.
But it's in the Senate report, so.
No, Justice Kagan, we think that the way to look at this statute is to try to figure out what Congress understood the statute to mean in 1952. And it's very clear, and I think both sides agree, that Congress intended to essentially incorporate the thrust of the judicial opinions that had been issued under the 1946 statute. Those opinions repeatedly talked about gross injustice, drawing from the prior legislative history. And when they awarded fees and when they discussed when fees would be appropriate, the circumstances that we list in our brief are what they said would equate to gross injustice. So I think in the abstract you may be right that gross injustice is a broader standard, or maybe it's a little bit only the most exceptional of exceptional cases would be covered. But in practice, what Congress was looking at and what they were responding to and what they were intending to put in this statute was an idea of gross injustice that reflected those bad faith, harassing, and unreasonable situations.
Well, if that's what you mean, why don't you say exceptional injustice instead of gross injustice?
We're trying to tie the interpretation of the statute to the language
To the Senate report.
Not just to the Senate report, Justice Scalia, but to the judicial decisions. And this Court has often looked to judicial decisions as a backdrop against which Congress legislates.
It's a different statute. Could we borrow from — you mentioned EJA. I take that's substantially justified.
Yes, Your Honor. We think
the different statute was passed later, all those problems.
We think that when the situation involves, say, just an objectively unreasonable argument, we think that essentially the same test would apply from the EJA context.
So is there anything other than the objectively baseless and bad faith of the Brooks Furniture test that you would change? Doesn't all of the other factors that the Court uses, litigation misconduct, all of that other stuff, encompass all the factors you're talking about?
I think it does, but I think it's very important if the Court were to go in that direction, as long as it elaborates a couple of the additional points that I mentioned earlier.
That it has to be a combination of factors.
That both are not required, that it can be a combination of factors, that when the Brooks Furniture test says unjustified, that embraces the concept of objective unreasonable.
I thought the Federal Circuit said that you only use the objective unreasonable if there isn't one of the other things.
So
it seems to be saying that it
I think they do, but I think that catch-all category in which they apply the two-pronged Brooks Furniture test covers potentially a very wide array of cases. Because it covers any case in which perhaps there's bad faith conduct in bringing the litigation, and also it covers the range of circumstances in which frivolous or unreasonable arguments are made.
And could you spend a moment on clear and convincing, and because there's not a whole lot in your briefs on that part of it, although you do mention it in passing.
Right. Yes, Justice Sotomayor. As the Court well knows, the standard rule in civil litigation is that facts need to be established by a preponderance of the evidence unless Congress says otherwise. The I-4-I case decided a few terms ago, I think, confirmed that general view. Here, Congress did not say otherwise. Congress did not embrace a clear and convincing standard. There's nothing in the text or the history of Section 285 that suggests that it did. I appreciate we didn't have I wish we had had more time in our brief to get into this issue, but I would just suggest that if the Court wants to look more deeply, it can look at Judge O'Malley's opinion in the Kelopass case, which I think has a very thorough and convincing discussion of the clear and convincing evidence issue.
What is the difference between you say the correct phrase is objectively unreasonable?
When we're dealing with just that, a case that raises a weak legal argument.
And that's different from objectively baseless. That's a little higher than objectively baseless.
It's not clear, Justice Alito, how the Federal Circuit conceives of it. And let me just explain why. I think they use the term objectively baseless. In some of their opinions, when they're talking about that term, they seem to use frivolous as a synonym. In other cases, when they're talking about that term, they seem to use objectively unreasonable. And so we think there's a little bit of confusion. We think the Pierce case makes very clear that justified and reasonableness are the same thing, and that a reasonable argument is not the same as merely a non-frivolous argument.
And that's higher than the Rule 11 standard?
The Rule 11 standard, when it comes to unreasonable arguments, is frivolous. And so we think that it should be a little bit lower than that standard, and it should be closer to something like in EJA. I would like to get to the Chief Justice's question earlier about why not defer to the Federal Circuit's view on this statute. And I think two principal reasons. First of all, I don't think the Federal Circuit's view really has any basis in either the text or the history of the Section 285. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is, I think, if the Federal Circuit had had a consistent view over its history, or if the Federal Circuit were not internally divided on this issue, that may be a consideration. Deference might be more appropriate. But here, there is no consistent history, and the Federal Circuit, as we've seen in Kilopass, is divided.
Thank you, counsel.